Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this Reboot Republic. Just a couple of things before we kick off. Obviously, I am looking for your support. The Tortoise Shack is listener-supported, member-led, and how you join us is you go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The link is at the top of the podcast you're listening to right now. The conversation you're about to hear with Dr. Kieran O'Carroll is a fantastic chat about climate action and social justice, which is so important to what we're trying to do. There is no climate action without social justice. There's also a brand new Reboot Republic going out to patrons right now with Hugh Brennan from the O'Coolon Cooperative. Hugh is a legend in actually delivering affordable homes and building communities and not just housing units. That's available, guess where? Patreon.com/Tortoiseshack. I'm sorry to be so cheesy, but we do need your support. Please come on board and please help us keep the show on the road.
Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And today I am absolutely delighted to be joined on the podcast by the wonderful Dr. Kieran O'Carroll, who is, and wait till you hear this now, he is a distinguished nonetheless, climate and sustainable transition expert, who's renowned for his extensive background in sustainability, consultancy and academia. With a career marked by unwavering dedication to sustainability, he's made significant contributions to major organizations such as L'Oreal, PwC, we're going to have to check out that one, and Change by Degrees. Listen, he's a lecturer in sustainability leadership at TU Dublin. Kieran, it's wonderful to have you on the pod.
Thanks very much, Rory. And I'm clearly going to have to delete that description and massively rework it. That cannot see the light of day ever again.
Listen, that's a description because you were appointed on to FISAIR and Screen Ireland, and congrats on that. But listen, we want to talk about sustainability, climate, and what we could do about it. And in particular, let's give people some hope and some fire. Greater understanding of what's going on and what we could do. There is a lot of, just start straight up, people feeling, and I was reading about it yesterday, this whole concept of the climate anxiety, the mental health impacts of people literally feeling just hopeless. And what can they do about it? Just sense of, impending doom, probably not helped by Netflix's new series, Three Bodies or whatever it's called. The aliens are coming in 400 years. But listen, climate change is happening now. Is there any hope?
Yeah, there's absolutely loads of hope. There's absolutely loads of hope, Rory, because there's way more of us than there is of them, very, very, very simply put. But I think anyone can clearly see with two eyes that we're at a very pivotal moment, a very pivotal moment. The UN, the IPCC is not wrong when it says what we do in the next few years will set the course of what happens to human society for the next thousand. I don't think that's an exaggeration in any shape or form. But what it does do is say to us that the actions that we can have in our lifetimes are going to echo. And so we have to win. We have to organize and we have to win because there's really no other choice. And the lives that we're living now and what we're tasked with is just incredibly important. And we have to win, and we have to start putting in place the strategies, the tactics, the organizing now to really, over the next couple of years, make sure we turn this kind of small run of defeats we're having, particularly at a new level, into victories. I think that's critical.
And can we do that, do you think? Can we turn these defeats? Can we start achieving real victories? Because I am seeing, particularly there's a lovely, if people follow it on Instagram, it's positive climate stories. And I think it's by Earthly News, and they are showing kind of positive things that are happening, like, countries looking at banning advertisement by fossil fuels, different extension of, nature restoration going on. But at some level, you feel these are really, they are fantastic and they're all needed, and, coming together, they make something big, but they're not transformative. Or maybe they are.
Yeah, look, I think every little bit helps, but I think you're right. What we're looking for is systemic transformative change. To give an example of one way, a couple of ways in which I think that could come about, and to use some learnings perhaps from where we're at with the nature restoration law, which is unfortunately been zombified.
Yeah.
At a European level by the actions of Italy, Hungary, the Netherlands, amongst others. You know, I really think it's really important that we learn from the EU's spectacular cave-in on the Green New Deal. Its choice to abandon cutting pesticide use in half, implementing green measures, banning toxic chemicals, and next on the chopping block looks like the EU's anti-deforestation regulation. Unless we learn from these, we're going to be doomed in a cycle of going around in circles where we don't get the systemic change we need. So maybe I'll just give you kind of my thoughts. I'll run down my thoughts a little bit.
Because
we're talking about Europe here, I want to actually talk a little bit about agriculture in France. And the reason is that France is the largest agricultural producer in the EU and sixth largest worldwide. So if the common agricultural policy and European agricultural policy isn't for French farmers, then who's it for, right?
Yeah.
And almost 20% of French farming households live below the French poverty line, right? That's twice as high as the national average in France. And in 2020, the rate of suicide amongst French farmers was 43% higher than the national average. And in the 10 years between 2010 and 2020, France lost 100,000 small-scale farms, okay? So let's look at some of the systemic reasons for this. The CAP's budget distribution favors large industrial farms, and this exacerbates poverty among small farmers.
Yeah.
French farmers, of course, have been deeply affected by rising costs of energy, but also EU free trade agreements like Mercosur. And if you see the farmers interviewed who are protesting on the streets of Brussels, this is one of the first issues they bring up about lower quality products entering the European market, which undercuts their prices and exacerbates their income and inequality crisis that we have. And then another very big one, which is applicable to France, but I think is a really key one for us all to understand, is the construction of giant retention bases for agricultural irrigation. France has been in the grip of its worst droughts on record for about 2 to 3 years now, right? Massive accelerated droughts due to climate change. And what is happening there is that agro-industrial big farming interests are building mega basins, which tap into underground reservoirs and suck up, steal the water of small-scale farmers. Okay. And small-scale farmers have an ever-decreasing access to overexploited water. And these policies are exacerbating issues for small farmers. So where am I going with this? Basically, is that the farmers that are out protesting on the streets in Brussels, when you see them interviewed and the message that's been given and the message that's been given to the EU politicians, of course, is an extremely powerful one. It's one of poverty, suicides, and water theft. But the gut blow is that the very laws they are protesting is the ones that might also do something to help them. So let's do a thought experiment. How do we turn those farmers who naturally should be on the side of nature restoration law from protesting it into supporting it and being out on the streets to support its passing? What would that look like? What would we have to do? And so here's where I'm getting into what I think we should look at doing, right? The first thing I think we need to take away from this is that we need to put, and this is at local, national, and European level, at all times, we need to put the just transition, social justice, at the heart of everything that we do, all the laws we seek to pass and changes we seek to make, and communicate it that way as well. So for example, the next time that we come to try and pass a bill, a law like the Nature Restoration Law, we do not call it the Nature Restoration Law. We call it instead something like the Farmer Anti-Poverty Law. And the headline of this law is that the goal of this law is to ensure that no farmer in Europe lives in poverty. And how do we do that? That's where we link it to nature restoration. That's where we say, okay, any farm that who opts into this will receive direct payments. And at a very minimum level, it will guarantee that any farmer opting into this will be elevated quickly and permanently, lifted out of poverty, and then some. Right. Mm-hmm. So instead of us approaching this from, we're going to take something away from you, which is how the far right have been communicating this effectively.
Yeah.
Instead of we're taking productive agricultural land away from you. And by the way, I do think it was a mistake that we didn't sort out the financing and have a clear message on financing to farmers. But so instead of it's something that's been taken away from you, we're giving you something. We're improving your lives measurably. Mm. And that is how we need to start designing laws, framing laws, and communicating laws, and putting social justice at the heart and redistribution of wealth in Europe at the heart of everything that we do going forward. That is my first kind of lesson to take away. I've got more, but
great. No, and I'd love to hear the others, but I think that is a fundamental point, and it's something that myself and others have been, you know, also communicating around, in particular, for example, about housing and the need for, you know, public retrofitting programs, so that it's not a case that if you can afford to retrofit your home, you get it done, and if you can't, you don't, and you pay the higher carbon taxes and carbon fuels and cost, that actually we should be having a rollout of public retrofitting for all, really, that's what we should have. And yes, it's going to cost, but as you say, like, it's still this whole notion of cost is just... Yeah. You know, bonkers. There's such narrow, short-term looking. But I think that's so interesting. And maybe to because there has been a lot of discussion about the nature restoration law. Maybe explain a little bit, if you could, like what actually was proposed and what did it end up being in terms of where it's at now.
So what was proposed essentially, top line, was that we'd have 20% of nature restored by 2030, and that all degraded nature areas in the EU would be fully restored. But by 2050, that's top line. Now, it was all the main challenges through the media and through the so-called, you know, kind of debate were communicated through farming. But it was so much broader than that. It was so much bigger than that. This was about forestry. This was about our towns. This was about preventing heat traps in cities. This is about preventing flooding in our towns and cities. It was really wide, ambitious, and you know, in the kind of academical sense, really, you know, if you're an academic and you looked in, you would go, yes. But from, you know, a social and just transition perspective, that, as I say, the consonant and the fact that it wasn't up front was ultimately, I think, why it failed. Another key kind of element in it, I think, was the debate where it kind of, we lost it, was the debate around how to finance it. And, you know, that's, I think, not having, a clear financing plan that was really locked tight. I mean, really locked tight. I know there was discussions about it would come out of current funding, and I was a little bit worried about the idea that private investment would be involved down the line. I, you know, I'm not a huge fan of things that we need to live being necessarily being in the hands of private investors. Look at housing. That wasn't nailed down, and that's why I think really a key lesson from this is, as I say, when we try and pass these laws, we need to nail the funding down, and we need to nail down how it's redistributive and how it's aligned with social justice. Where it is now is that essentially it was passed by the European Parliament. I mean, we all remember that, right? February,
yes.
all the cheering, and this was great.
And very interestingly, a number of Irish MEPs voted against it.
yeah, absolutely. And you know, I know Ming, you know, voted against it, and one of the reasons that one of the key reasons he said, well, you know, it was the financing. And, you know, I do have sympathy with that, as I said, you know.
Not wrong. But he's not wrong.
Yeah.
I would say to people, go listen to Ming's conversation with Pádraig Fógarty on it, and they were pretty much on the same page on most of it.
Absolutely.
So again, I wish we had better news for people, but Luke's right to have a certain amount of skepticism. So I'll butt out.
Oh, absolutely. I think 100%. And I think the whole question is, how do you get change around that, and how, and what it communicates, and who you're trying to communicate to. And, you know, you're saying, like, as you say, the nature restoration laws and bills and what was being proposed was offering dramatic change. Of course, it wasn't the best of what could have been done, but the opposition to it was also playing into this sense that this is against farmers, rather than actually going, this is what agriculture needs, and then it needs to be financed.
Absolutely. Financing is just too important. And as well, we missed the opportunity to say that the financing would be redistributive, it would be fair, and it would lift people out of poverty. We left that gaping wide open. And I think we need to really kind of learn from that going forward. And just to finish off on where it is now, is that it's on the desk of the European Environmental Committee, made up of European ministers. It should be a rubber stamped committee. It is passed by the EU Parliament. They should just rubber stamp it and should be law. But what has happened is ministers from, say, Italy, Hungary, the Netherlands, I think Sweden as well, have basically said, we're not rubber stamping it. And this is, if you enjoy things like democracy in Europe, this is really worrying. This is really worrying because it's been passed by the elected representatives. It should be rubber stamped and it's not going through. And if this becomes a standard kind of playbook at European legislative level, this is highly concerning, that legislation laws passed by the elected representatives in the EU then goes on to not be rubber stamped for political reasons. We should all be highly concerned by that as anyone who wants to be part of a democracy. I think then just to, you touched on housing there, Rory, and mm-hmm. other key issues. And I think this is kind of the second key learning that I think is absolutely critical from this. And, you know, this isn't something, of course, and any ideas, none of my ideas or anything I invented. I stand on the shoulder of much better thinkers. But when I look at this, I think the second lesson has to be coalition building, has to be partnership building between different groups in society who all share similar goals, whether it's housing, whether it's farming, whatever it may be. We are too fragmented. And we need to bring all of these groups together across Europe and beyond and into the Global South and learn from the Global South as one. Build a grand coalition. And we also need to be highly visible to the people in power. I want to give an example as well. I'm going back to France again, just because I think it's interesting just to look at some different areas. And in France, we have an emerging kind of example that's not perfect, but I think it's an example to kind of raise. Le Soulèvement de la Terre, which is an example of, I think, of what is possible in this direction. In March 2023, 6,000 people from many backgrounds, from rural, from small-scale farming, environmentalists, academics, you name it. It was a coalition, a Rainbow Coalition, organized a protest against major mega reservoir projects, the stealing of water from small-scale farmers. In Saint-Soulin. The French state is so scared of this movement, so scared of people coming together from different protest groups that they banned them, which confused everyone at the time, because how do you ban a protest movement? Is ultimately overturned by the French courts in November. And since it's been unbanned, it was more popular than ever. And I think this is a good example of what we need to do. We need to bring everyone together in the same banner for social justice, whether that's farming, whether that's housing, whether that's health, and see our protest movements as part of the one. And as I say, also, we need to link in to activists and leaders from indigenous communities and the Global South as well. There's lessons to be learned from Le Soulèvement de la Terre as well. I think one of the key lessons is that, you know, the farmers protesting the nature restoration law, who ultimately were successful, were doing it in Brussels. They were doing it in the face of power in Paris as well. And I think it's very important to be visible to the lawmakers who decide and the bureaucrats who decide on this law. The big protest that they staged was in rural France at the mega basin. And I get why they chose that. But also, it's very far away from the politicians in power who can feel very safe watching it on their TV screens. And ultimately, it allowed the police a kind of free rein to fire over 4,000 tear gas and flashbang grenades at the protesters, right? It was an open field, very little cover, and it resulted in over 200 of the protesters being injured. So I think we have to think very strategically about the places we protest as well, to make sure that we're in the centers of power, having the biggest influence we can, and don't leave ourselves exposed on open ground to violent police repression. I think another key lesson as well from this movement is that we have to make sure as well that we're combating racism at the same time. This then, speaking about France, there's systemic racism in France. And I think the police and the powers that have seen that there's an opportunity to divide protesters along racial lines. And the truth is that protesters from, for example, the former French colony backgrounds and Arab protesters, when they were targeted by the police, were not supported by white climate activists. And we need to change that absolutely as well, and make sure that we're all together in this grand coalition and really meaning it and supporting each other. So I think a big lesson too is this need to coalition build, support each other, and be really protesting at the center of power at the pivotal moments. It was the farmers who were there at the pivotal moment for the nature restoration law. Next time we need to be there with the small scale farmers as well.
And I think that there's, you know, you're absolutely right around the need to, you know, build coalitions across society. And in particular, in the context of it, society becoming so much more fractured and, you know, the rise of the far right and the rise of, you know, the anti-climate, anti-migrant politics that is, you know, dividing, you know, movements and potential for change, and then the shift in the center towards that as well then. And you know, rather than trying to look to appease maybe, you know, a social democratic left, they're looking now to appease a far right, and where that's drifting and going to shift policies to in the next European Parliament. A lot of people are really, really worried that, you know, any sort of progress is just going to be completely rolled back. And even limited and all as that progress was, the need is to go further rather than to go backwards. But a question that comes to mind is a couple of things. One is that the issue of the farmers protesting, and, you know, absolutely, and the same in Ireland, you know, there's so many farmers who are part-time farmers, you know, my brother is a part-time farmer, who are on, you know, average incomes, you know, they're just about, you know, getting by, and they would absolutely, you know, any major changes would need to be and should be about lifting their incomes. And they would also be people who are completely open, understand the needs to change the practices to restore nature, and would only love to be involved in that, but properly financially supported. But then you have the agri-food industry, and you have the giant farmers who are completely opposed to, not all of them, but, you know, in large scale are much more, it goes against their interests more to have more nature restoration and to have shift away from the subsidies going to the mass production and the agri-food industry itself. And so while we see the farmers, it's how much are these smaller farmers being used by those agri-food industry and the big farmers as essentially kind of, you know, oh, look, we're really struggling. Well, we're actually not. We just want the system to keep going as it is. And how do you differentiate around that? There's not one farming lobby. There's not one farming group. It's quite divided in and of itself. And how do we communicate that? And I think try and get around, I suppose, win those smaller farmers over to a sustainable, socially just model of transition.
I mean, absolutely, Rory. I think number one is, as I already said, I think we need to make it clear that we are the one with who wants to put into law policies that will lift every single farmer out of poverty and then some to a good standard of living, and that we are the ones who want to do that. Whereas the big agro companies don't have an interest in doing that, right? Because they benefit from the exploitation of small scale farmers. I think that's number one. Number two is we also need to show them, especially on climate change, again, that we are the ones that are actually thinking of them, and we are the ones that have the solution. Farming, I don't think it's controversial to say farming representative organizations like the IFA just aren't on the pitch when it comes to climate change. And I think when you look at the disastrous weather that we're having for farmers, that farmers know, as you say, farmers know, right? They can see climate change happening before their eyes, especially smaller scale and part-time farmers, right? Really impacts them, right? They don't have the big capital to invest in like the big industrial does to kind of wave it off that they can for a couple of years. And the thing is about this wet weather, right? That we're having, this is the beginning, right? This we know from climate science that as the earth warms, that there's more precipitation, that, you know, clouds, more moisture gets sucked up, more rain gets dumped. And so for Ireland, you know, it's kind of like that, you know, that Simpsons meme people might be familiar with, you know, where Bart says, this is the worst day of my life. And Homer says, this is the worst day of your life so far. It's kind of like, this is the wettest year of our lives, of my life. Oh no, this is just the wettest year of your life so far. Is that we need to show farmers that we are the ones with the long-term plans that are going to keep their farms viable, sustainable, and keep them living happy, healthy, dignified lives as custodians of the earth. Because the farming organizations don't have an answer to this, and neither does Big Agri, right? And just to kind of add as a supplemental into that, a minor moan, a minor gripe. My God, like listening to the discussion on this on RTE, I think it was it Sarah McInerney and the Minister for Agriculture on Drive Time yesterday. They spoke about it for about 15 minutes. Not once was climate change mentioned, as the fact that this is now just the regular occurrence in our climate. And so we need to be giving farmers the long-term transformative supports to make farming viable here in Ireland. Because if we're saying that with this amount of rain, the farming it isn't viable in Ireland with this kind of weather, then farming isn't viable in Ireland going forward. You know, we need to come to that with our current system, come to that realization very, very fast. And as I think John Gibbons would say, you know, beating that drum for a long-term food security plan, that what we currently have just isn't fit for purpose. And we need to hold that part of the pitch and show ourselves that we are the ones with the solution.
I want to make one quick point from above. It's just that on the food sustainability, we've covered across Torrishack for a number of years. Ireland boasts, you know, enough food to feed 60 million people, but we're a part of a global food chain, and most of the stuff we're actually importing stuff to feed livestock. We are, our own food chain is very, very weak. Not only that though, but it was worrying to see reporting going in. The government are going to now give additional funding to farmers because of these exceptional circumstances. That's not dealing with reality, as Kieran has quite rightly pointed out. This isn't exceptional circumstances, this is probably the new normal. So people need to get used to that idea and just and understand that if we have to do that, we have to build sustainable food chains, global supply chains that are going to work to our benefits and cut back on those food miles because we want it from farm to fork, as they say. And there's very little of real talk about that because ultimately, you know, you can read the Farmer's Journal and get told that everything is the death of rural Ireland. Everything is the death of rural Ireland. Well, that's not clearly not the case. So, yeah, rant over. I'll leave you guys to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I was to say something, you know, kind of positive. You know, I was reading the article about the I think it was Limerick. The Limerick council saying climate change is a Marxist host. hoax. But pleased to see that the article did report, I think it was a Fine Gael member of the IFA stand up and say, it's not, this is real and this is impacting farmers now. So as you say, you know, Roy, farmers get it. And I think along with the financing, we need to be showing the ones that we are on side. We need to listen to farmers. We need to form coalitions with farmers and we need to come up with joint solutions and protest together for the transformative change that is required. Because otherwise, you know, farming will not be sustainable in Ireland on our current track. And I would also just add in very briefly as well that we really need especially our public economists who have public platforms to really start getting on board with the climate change reality. Our economic forecast and kind of economic opinion pieces that we have in the media are not taking climate change into account. And we really need this community communicated to the public the fact that, you know, climate change is, unless we start taking these kind of actions, is going to get worse. And it's going to significantly transform our economy in ways that's not being currently communicated, you know, to the public. I think that's critical as well, just kind of off the back of the
United
Ireland 20 billion. It's like that report's lovely, but it doesn't matter because you're not thinking about climate change, you know. A bit of a tangent here, but with United Ireland, well, what's your industrial strategy for United Ireland, especially in the north? Are you going to turn it into building wind farms and the kind of the industrial jobs, well-paying industrial jobs that we need to adapt and mitigate climate change? If you are, then I think there's a fantastic economic opportunity for United Ireland. But if you're just saying we're going to keep bouncing around as we are right now, then you got problems. But it's all about smart industrial policy. Like, so our economists really need to start thinking about climate change properly.
Yeah. But also, the whole notion of, I think you're absolutely right in terms of economics and, you know, economic industrial strategy, the whole notion that we can continue on with this idea of measuring our economies on the basis of GDP and GNI and economic growth, it's absolute, hell, you know, we need to stop and just go, look, we've things all wrong here. We have to start measuring through, you know, the health of the planet or the well-being of ourselves, the well-being of nature. And I think that again comes back to there is a real potential for an alignment of and joining up of climate question, climate, you know, a transformation through climate with a transformation through, as you say, social justice, but, you know, addressing inequality, addressing well-being, changing our economies and societies to be orientated around. And Ian Gough, I don't know if you've come across Ian Gough before. He's written a book, Heat, Greed and Human Need. He's a social policy guy who I would use a lot in my lectures. And he, you know, described it really well, that we need to meet human needs within planetary boundaries. And, you know, it's similar to K. Rayward's donut economics, but it is this idea that social need and planetary boundaries are the two things we have to work around, and that's it, human needs, and, you know, they should be our priorities, and that's how we should be running our economy. But you're right, that's not the discussion in the economics. It's all like, oh, you know, like even the notion of building more offices and building hotels when we need to be building sustainable homes and retrofitting homes. And I was just looking at there, I don't know, the SEAI did their retrofitting report on last year in terms of retrofitting of homes. And they said, you know, it was really up last year on the previous year, which was great to see. But the scale of what they said is needed in terms of our own targets, that we need 75,000 B2 equivalent home upgrades per year from 2026 to 2030. And we did about, I think it was 17,000 last year. And that was up on the previous year. So we have to go to 17,000 to 75,000. The big shortage, skilled workers, of course, it's money as well, the cost and investment. And that comes back to, we're putting 8 billion into this, you know, these various funds that they say will address climate change and the future pensions. And you're going, but you need to invest it now.
Yeah. Well, I agree. Obviously, agree with everything you said, and I think, you know, speaking of things like donut economics, and systems analysis, it's very clear that we need to make an intervention in the system, and the most effective place to make an intervention in our economic system is right at the top. Right, it's the paradigm change, whereby instead of our current paradigm, where our economic system is driven towards GDP growth. And that is the be-all and end-all. And so everything in that system gets twisted and torn towards that, whether it's housing, whether it's health, whether it's agroforestry. We need to change what's at the top of the paradigm, top of the system, from GDP growth to human well-being within planetary boundaries. And it needs to then all flow down throughout the system. So we can make kind of tweaks and changes throughout. And that's why, you know, people like your good self, Rory, like you're battling housing. Other people are fighting the environmental battle. Other people are fighting the housing battle, the education battle. All these crises we have in the system is that we all need to band together and fight for that systemic change at the top. The purpose of the system, change it from GDP growth to human well-being within planetary boundaries. And that is, we have to make that change. It's the most effective change. And that's why us all coming together. And when we're out on the streets campaigning for housing, we're also campaigning for healthcare. We're also campaigning for the environment. We're also campaigning for the people crossing the Mediterranean. And we're doing it all together as one, maximum numbers, maximum visibility, maximum pressure. And I think that's the root of the systemic change that we need to transform all of our society.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And I think it is the hope in coming together that, you know, can offer an alternative to the just sense of despair and the, you know, the far right. And, you know, you spoke there in terms of the Mediterranean. There's two things I want to talk about just before we finish. The first is migration and climate change and what we're doing, and the second is the ecocide and genocide in Gaza. Just before we finish, you wanted to talk about the you know, migration and the Mediterranean and just what we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I was listening to Simon Harris's comments made at the Fine Gael gathering at Athlone, and where he was saying he wants a fair and firm model for immigration to this country. And I thought, well, a fair and firm model for who? The cabinet has opted into the EU migration and asylum pact that the Irish Refugee Council says is more about controlling and reducing the rights of individuals than an emphasis on fair and efficient asylum processes. And I think as a European citizen, the actions that are being carried out in my name follow me with horror. Since 2014, almost 30,000 men, women and children have died or disappeared in the Mediterranean Sea. A staggering number, likely a significant underestimation. The Mediterranean Sea is the world's deadliest migration route now. And ignoring international law, ignoring its own human rights law, the EU has invested millions in surveillance and collaboration with horrific dictators and warlords, not to save lives, but to intercept boats fleeing danger. And we as EU citizens are complicit in the forcing back of over 120,000 people into Libyan detention alone, described by the Pope as concentration camps, where children have no education, pregnant women denied care, there's starvation, there's torture, and there's shootings. The European Court of Justice ruled back in 2012 that asylum seekers on their way to Europe must not be brought to Libya because of the risk of torture and death. Yet the EU is training and financing the Libyan Coast Guard, establishing control centers for them, and provides them with the location data for boats that are making the crossing, essentially saying, you pick them up, you come and get them, forcing them back into the concentration camps. And I think we have to include this in the changes that we need to make in the EU. This is absolutely vital. And there's a few things that we also have to start doing. And we have to change our language around how we discuss this. We have to always make sure we're referring to these people as people. These are doctors, nurses, farmers. These are people with people who love them, with parents. And we need to bring humanity in this and stop it urgently. And we also need to recognize as well, of course, that this could be portrayed to us, I think a little bit in Ireland, as like some sort of sudden crisis that's just appeared. But Europe's legacy of colonialism and exploitation, which many Europeans, especially in France, Germany, etc., refuse to acknowledge, but reverberates today, and that nearly everyone risking their lives on that Mediterranean crossing comes from a former European colony, and that climate change that is fueled by the West is driving this displacement. Of course, Ireland has 51 times the emissions of Somalia. And I really think we need to get wise very, very quick. We need to change the narrative. These are not economic migrants or migrants. These are people. And I think one of the vital things and quick wins, if there were quick wins that we can have on this, is that we need to start putting people with direct experience of forced migration into decision-making positions on this in Europe. They have the knowledge, they have solutions, they have the experience, and we need to get them and partnerships with them to design safe routes and ensure once they reach Europe as well, that they have a dignified existence and replace our current brutality. I cannot bang this drum enough about what the EU is. This is official policy, is happening in the Mediterranean. Of our own doing.
And if there was specific I completely agree with you. And in terms of, you know, trying to get things done and giving people something, okay, what can they say to people that should be done? To policymakers immediately? Are you saying, you know, give people with direct experience, but what other measures do you think should be done?
I think we need to hound our MEPs remorselessly. I think, you know, the European elections are coming up, and we need to make it clear that this is a major issue. As I say, that when we're forming coalitions and groups to demand social justice and the change we need in our societies, that the migration crisis is also at its core, as it is at the core of the crisis of global inequality. I think that that's critical. And I think as well is that we need, it's kind of a reiteration, but I say they should be put in decision-making places, the people who have experienced forced migration, but we need to be having at all levels of our organization, people who want to share these experiences, and we need to listen to them. We need to listen to what they're telling us. And we need to make sure that we're platforming their voices in as many places as we possibly can, and making people in power realize that, no, we don't want these people drowning in the Med. We do not want these people forced back into concentration camps. We see them as part of the solution to a more equal and a fairer Europe, as part of this transition work that we have to do across society.
Absolutely. No, I agree 100%. And I will absolutely, in the coming weeks, be pushing that and banging that drum in my campaigning. So it is so true. And we just have to keep doing it. And by doing it, we will hopefully change the narrative as well. And the language, as you say, is so important. Just finally, I wanted to just briefly talk about Gaza and just a couple of nice things in all this absolute horror. There is an amazing nice things. I don't know how to even to describe these, and I know it's very difficult. I suppose, again, trying to see positive action that people are doing. Bowes Football Club, people are probably aware, have organised a really important event coming up the 15th of May in Dalymount. Is Bowes women's team are playing the Palestinian national women's team, which is going to be an incredible event. Kieran, you got tickets. I've got tickets.
I got my tickets. Can't wait.
Yeah, it's a really important event, act of solidarity, and it is to commemorate the Nakba. And listen, well done to Bowes for that. People can go onto the Bowes website and get tickets. Also, the Irish Palestine Solidarity Campaign are organising ongoing events. They're holding an event actually today, along with others, around the children, marking the 15,000 plus children who've been massacred and murdered in Gaza at the US embassy. But please check out their events and there's protests, ongoing protests around the boycotts. And if you're interested, there's also a letter that I've signed and other academics are signing, calling on the presidents of Irish universities to come out and support, call for a ceasefire, and boycott Israel as well. There's lots of things people can do. Just wanted to briefly touch, Kieran, the eco side. And people have also been pointing out that as part of this, along with genocide, that the destruction of the environment in Gaza and possibility of future life for Gazans and nature there.
Absolutely. And just to say as well that, you know, the ecocide has been taking place for a long time in occupied Palestinian lands in the West Bank and in Gaza, and the land grabs, of course, by Israeli settlers in the West Bank. And we've seen long history in the West Bank, for example, of Palestinians' water supplies and aquifers being concreted over so they could no longer take part in agriculture, and seeing their olive trees cut down. So the Israeli Defense Forces committing ecocide is unfortunately nothing new, but I think it's fair to say we've seen it taken to a new level in Gaza, where it seems that they have a scorched earth policy where they want nothing to be able to regrow. Seems to be a strategy, or at least it's definitely the outcome of what they're doing. And it's just another thing on the long list of crimes that they are committing, but certainly it appears that they are trying to do in the Palestinians' food supply that they rely on now and well into the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, again, as I said, there's so much we can do and we need to do on this. And people can check out the Irish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. And please do, if you can, support their actions. Kieran, I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks,
it was great to chat to you and meet you. And best of luck in all the work. Have you anything coming up that's interesting, engaging, or are you just on
always
journey?
Oh wait, I'm on the journey, but I'm kind of lucky enough at the moment to be able to link in with a couple of Palestinian universities and offer solidarity essentially in the West Bank. I kind of had relationships with a couple of them for about 14, 15 years now. And some of the work that they're doing to continue education in the face of such challenges is just, incredible and inspiring and remarkable, and just being able to kind of connect in with these teachers and students and just might do even a tiny bit to help them with that is just remarkable. So that's kind of the kind of thing I'm trying to do at the moment as well.
Very good. Very good. Well, listen, that's great work. And if anybody is remotely interested, this podcast probably might or might not go out in time. I don't know, Tony. I'm speaking in Trim tomorrow as part of my ongoing campaigning. In the Sally Rogers bar at 3 o'clock, the podcast might be going out. But for others who don't make that one, I will be in Carrick and Shannon on the 15th, Monday the 15th. Really looking forward to that. I'm speaking down there. People can check that out. It is Monday the 15th. It is in the evening. And also then I'm very excited. I'm going to Drogheda to speak at on dereliction with Derelict Drogheda and community group down there. That's going to be the 25th of April. So there's lots going on. And Martin Leahy is also having his 100th protest at the Dáil at 1 o'clock on the 18th. So that should be a really, really, really significant day. And if people can get down to support Martin on that day. Thank you so much, listeners, as always, for taking the time. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you found it engaging and interesting and informative. And if you can, please share it around and let people know you're listening. Give us your comments, feedback. Always love them. Always appreciate it. Particularly the ones that are slagging off Tony. And if you want to as well, please go over to patreon.com/TortoiseShack. Keep the lights on, keep the show on the road. Thank you very much, Slán, and we'll see you soon.